From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those open lines and a visit from the guy from Pittsburgh as he talks about time. Here's what's happening. Hurricane Matthew moving up the Atlantic coast of the U.S. right now, threatening some of the southeast most historic sites and cities after leaving more than 1 million people without power in Florida. Four deaths already reported in the United States, 800 deaths in Haiti. Dr. Tim Ball, climatologist, has been with us since Matthew's been creeping up the country. Tim, what's the latest out there?
Well, the latest is that, as I talked about last night, Matthew continues to hold its strength. It's decreasing slightly down Category 3, Category 2, because it continues over the water, which is, of course, its source of energy.
Mm-hmm.
But it is decreasing because as it moves north, the water is cooler. And also as it moves north, it swings to the right away from the land because it gets caught up in what's called the Coriolis force, which is related to the spin of the earth. But if it had gone over the land over the last couple of days, it would have dissipated almost completely by now. The big issue, George, is the storm surge. And one of there are three components to this. People don't understand what it is. But when you get low pressure, and it's quite a low-pressured hurricane, down to about 930 millibars, the sea level rises up, because the weight of the atmosphere on the ocean pushes down on it. So when you get a low pressure, the surface of the ocean actually bulges up. And that's what you get moving along with the center of the hurricane. And when that moves on shore, of course, it's just like a very, very long wave, almost like a tsunami wave moving onto the shore. If you get that combined with the onshore winds and occurring at high tide, and there's a high tide forecast for the Georgia coast at 2 o'clock this morning, that combination can create the flooding. And of course, in all of the major hurricanes throughout history, it's the flooding that's the biggest killer. We still don't have an accurate count of the number of people that died with Katrina. The 1900 hurricane that hit Galveston, Texas, 6,000 people drowned because of the drowning. And so the flooding and the drowning are really the biggest issues due to this combination of the storm surge, the high tide, and the onshore winds.
Tim, Hillary Clinton trying to use this hurricane as an excuse for man-made climate change. I bet I know what you're going to say about that.
Yes. Well, of course, it's the hurricane region. And if you live in Florida and that coast, you expect hurricanes, they're going to occur. I think the bigger problem is the failure. Look at the amount of power outage. I mean, they know these things are going to occur. Why isn't there better, more secure power supply systems for the area? And why aren't there better controls over the houses that people build and the dangers that they put themselves in? Now, evacuation is one thing. But, there maybe should be some zoning. I'm saying you're living in a hurricane zone and you've either got to carry a lot of insurance or be prepared to accept the consequences of that. And this idea of zoning the world on the basis of natural disasters, you know, the tornado alley through Oklahoma, Texas, and so on, really raises some very interesting questions about insurance and people living in areas of natural disasters.
Okay, Tim, thank you so much. We'll see what happens over the weekend with Hurricane Matthew. Let's hope it just breaks down to a tropical storm. Big story tonight, of course, and you can talk with me about it if you want during open lines. A leaked video from 2005 capturing Donald Trump using bizarre, lewd language discussing women with a television host just before he made a cameo appearance on a soap opera. I'm not even going to get into what he said. You probably have seen it. But Donald did a videotape statement tonight where he apologized for what he said back in 2005. It was crude, folks, and unbecoming of him, to be sure. A fragment of a plane wing discovered in May has been confirmed as coming from missing plane Malaysia Airlines MH370. It's the third piece of debris now to be definitively linked to MH370. Flight 370 vanished on March 8, 2014, after taking off from Kuala Lumpur on a flight towards Beijing with 239 people on board. I think the pilot tanked that plane. The calculated execution of a Los Angeles County Sheriff's Sergeant Wednesday is one of 97 cases of officers in America and Puerto Rico who have been killed in the line of duty this year, three victims this week alone. A Massachusetts police department posted on Facebook a photo of a man in a clown mask who they said stalked middle school students when they got off a school bus earlier this week. The police said the man turned out to be the father of a kid who was on the bus, and he now is facing disorderly conduct and disturbing the peace charges. Not smart. A California not-for-profit was having a hard time serving a Kuwaiti sheikh with law papers, a lawsuit, so it got permission to do most of it in a digital way. The judge approved the filing of the suit and the serving of it on Twitter. Wow, what a change. U.S. employment growth unexpectedly slowed for the third straight month in September, which would make the Federal Reserve more cautious about raising interest rates. You got to look at the story at coasttocoastam.com and the highlight reel. A camera in Michigan set up to film an eagle's nest has caught something else on film. Some say it looks like the legendary creature Bigfoot. This was taken in May. The footage is not clear. The camera was in a tree close to a state fish hatchery, and the creature, whatever it is down on the ground, but it is strange. What else is strange? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do you have for us this week?
Yeah, there are always strange things going on up here, George.
Oh, yeah.
As you well know, some interesting reports, including what appears to be an electromagnetic pulse or electromagnetic interference case from Houston I'll talk about in a minute or so, but a couple prefatory comments. First one is, on days of broadcast, I usually spend most of my day updating the website. This week, our webmaster's out of town. He's decided to use this week to perfect his California tan over on the Waikiki Beach, and he promises he'll be back by Sunday. So the Coast listeners are just going to have to take my word on some of these dramatic cases
we shall
tonight. Also, I'd like to preface with two very interesting cases, which, as far as I know, George, have nothing to do with UFOs, but I thought the Coast audience would find them interesting nevertheless. They probably don't know about them. But on Monday evening of this week, I received a report about a military activity in central Massachusetts out of Westover Air Force Base that occurred on Monday morning, the 3rd of October. People were awakened, or people saw orange lights through solid fog, ground fog, and it was accompanied by sonic booms of jet fighters going overhead on afterburner. The local commander said it was nothing but F-15s en route to a distant point. He didn't say where that point was. And I wouldn't even mention this case if it were not for the case that was reported from North Pole, Alaska, the day after. This makes it Tuesday afternoon, the 4th of October. Two sources whom I consider to be, I know them well, I consider them to be unimpeachable sources of accurate information, reported that on Tuesday afternoon at that time, 6:15 p.m., they were witness to two flights of fighters going out of Eielson Air Force Base. The first flight was I think you call it a squadron if it's six aircraft, of F-18s departing to the west out of Eielson, was followed by an AWACS that was moving very rapidly, F-18s on afterburner, by the way, and following the AWACS plane, another squadron of F-16s departing at very high speed on afterburner. They all turned north and disappeared from sight. Very, very unusual launch. And what makes it really interesting is that all of the 12 fighters were painted white, George. Never seen an F-18 in albino color.
No, me either.
very unusual. The Marines and Navy fly that those aircraft, but there was something very unusual going on there. Again, I don't have any reason to believe that it was related to a UFO phenomenon or sighting, but I mention it because I thought the audience would find it very interesting. Well, back down to ground level, a week ago tonight, the 30th of September, a group of about 15 or 20 people were partying in Oxnard, California. They saw a very interesting light come down from the north, headed south. It suddenly stopped as they watched it, hovered for 5 to 8 minutes. The white light went out, and it suddenly became a red light, and equally suddenly it shot back to the north. That happened 3 times over 30 minutes. Don't know what the object was, but it was a very, very unusual sighting, and we'll have that posted probably on Sunday of this weekend. Next case involves the EMP case. This is from Houston. Sunday morning, the 2nd of October, he was either up late or up early. I'm not sure which, but suddenly, as he was working on his computer, his cable service went out, and a short time later, all the power in his neighborhood failed. It went totally dark, George. Wow. He went outside, and he saw an aquamarine or aqua-green object floating across the sky. Suddenly, it just accelerated and shot up into the night sky, according to his version. And a minute or so later, what he thinks was a military helicopter went streaking overhead, headed directly for the area where he had last seen that aquamarine shimmering object. He had no idea what it was. Last couple of sightings. One is from Meadville, Pennsylvania. This morning, two gentlemen arrived at work and saw, again, an aquamarine object in the morning sky.
Something's going on.
Something's going on, and I'm getting reports of these green objects on a routine basis. And last report comes tonight, just 2 hours ago, from Arvada, Colorado. A person who elects to remain anonymous, provided no contact information, unfortunately, reports that he saw a missile-shaped object with yellow lights streak overhead. He saw it for only about 10 seconds or so. Very, very interesting sighting. I hope he's a Coast listener and we'll get back in touch. We'll have these and many more reports posted to our website Sunday of this weekend.
Super. Thanks, Peter. Peter Davenport from the UFOCenter.com, UFOCenter.com, National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, The Agony That Remains, a paranormal investigation in America's heartland. Brandon Callahan joins me with a very scary story. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to talk about a paranormal investigation for the next couple hours with Brandon Callahan. Grew up with an insatiable desire to learn everything he could about mysterious things. And he's been actively investigating paranormal activity in the field for many years now and has developed his own method of tracking potential hotspot locations throughout the world. His latest work is called The Agony That Remains. Brandon, Oklahoma, welcome to the show.
Hey, George, how's it going?
Good. Looking forward to this. Nothing better than a Friday night getting close to Halloween to talk about paranormal investigations, and you've got some great ones.
That's right. It's that time of year, so definitely someone like myself, it definitely brings kind of lifts me up a little bit when the fall comes around and everybody's kind of excited for the scary side of things, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Hey, tell us a little bit more, Brandon, about yourself and how you got involved in all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just, as the bio kind of runs down real briefly, I just always had a real fascination for anything mysterious when I was a kid and growing up. And I had a lot of fears. And as I grew up and kind of developed a new perspective, I spent 5 years in the Air Force, and most of that was overseas. I really started to dive into the spiritual side of my life and had a few experiences that I really just couldn't explain away. And nothing really super frightening, but it was just more that I couldn't understand it. And so when I came back after being overseas, I decided to really start getting serious about going out and really trying to find out for myself what was out there. I've always found it more intriguing to go and, you know, have that first-person perspective as opposed to just hearing the stories.
Right. How often do you depend on and have to these events when you investigate? How much time do you spend?
It varies per location. A lot of times we've been doing a whole lot of traveling. I actually live in Kansas City, and this particular story down in Oklahoma, it took us 5 hours to drive, and we'd go down pretty regular. So most of the time we'd go all night, you know, 8 to 10 hours at a time, sometimes longer, just depending on really what was going on at the time. But then again, every now and again, you know, a few hours, we felt like we did what we needed to do at the time. And so really it just kind of depends on the location, and a lot of it depends exactly on, you know, what is going on at the time.
How did you find this story in Oklahoma? Has it been well known to people?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I was doing a lot of research. One of my main focuses of research is on ley line studies, and there just so happened to be, according to the file that I use that kind of leads me in the right direction and along those lines of that theory, it led me down to Tahlequah, Oklahoma, where there are several intersecting ley lines. So that really piqued my interest. It's one of the largest clusters of ley lines, really, in my vicinity. So I started doing some research, and it didn't take long to find really kind of a tragic past. It's where the Trail of Tears ended, which really kind of struck me personally from the very beginning of my research. And I just so happened to be put in touch with these gentlemen that own this property. Their family had owned it for generations, really since the Trail of Tears, a couple of Cherokee gentlemen down there. And we went down there, and I was just completely blown away. It was unlike any place I've ever been and any place I've been since. And we really bonded, and it turned into over a 5-year project.
And they call it the Trail of Tears because it was forced relocations of Indian nations in the United States, and the people who were constantly relocated suffered disease, starvation, and all kinds of things getting to where they were going, right?
Yeah, it's some of the most tragic and horrific stuff that I've ever really researched, and, you know, frankly, the research was nothing to the stories that have been handed down over the generations of the actual occurrences along the trail of, you know, just horrific mutilation and torture. It was, you know, by saying a forced relocation is exactly what it was, but it really doesn't even touch the tip of the iceberg as to the extremities of it and just the absolute atrocity. It really broke my heart.
Hence the title, The Agony That Remains, I assume.
Yeah, it really was. And the, you know, there are certain places in an investigator's life and career that really tend to make their mark on that person and that group of people. And this is definitely one that has changed my outlook on a lot of things and definitely changed my approach as an investigator and a writer. It really has been a life-changing experience, for sure.
Brandon, there's a little picture of a little house on the cover of your book. What's that depict?
You know, there were actually two houses on the property that we focused on, and the likeness was pretty uncanny because, really, I had shown Llewellyn, the publisher, some pictures, but initially there was kind of a different vision as far as the cover, and I think we all know if you've seen their books, they do incredible covers.
Well, they do, and, yeah. They capture.
Yeah, they presented that one, and really, it really stunned me. It does depict electricity in the house, but the house we were really focused on was really tattered and broken down, but it was almost as though it's kind of a look into its past when it was more functional, when a lot of these strange occurrences started for this family as they were really, really young.
All right, stay with us. Brandon Callahan with us. We're going to talk more about his investigation next hour. Your calls. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Brendan Callahan with us, The Agony That Remains. Brendan, tell us the method that you used for this investigation, how you keyed in on it, and did you bring certain kinds of equipment? What did you do?
Well, we typically have a pretty standard set of equipment. We use a lot of audio equipment, some handheld cameras, and in some instances we're able to set up some standstill cameras. But really, in this instance, we had just set out on what was going to be a week-long trip. We were going to make stops all the way from Kansas City down to New Orleans and back. So it was kind of a road trip deal, really, and Tahlequah was the night number two that we had stopped. And so what I really brought to the table in that one, just given a little bit of history and a little bit of the story behind it, I had actually prepped some notes and some very basic translated questions into the traditional Cherokee language. And what I wanted to do is try to bring that Native American feel and spirit to it, to, you know, show my respect and to attempt some sort of communication. And things actually started happening almost immediately when we arrived down there. And that night when we started using the translations, it was without any delay whatsoever, I was starting to hear my name, and there was all sorts of activity that kicked up really before we could even blink.
Were you scared out there?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at first, well, the first real occurrence was actually in the day. We had been getting a tour by the owners, the two brothers that own the property, and my partner, he had actually, you know, about an hour after it being told to us that people see this lady all the time on the property, he said that he had seen this lady just clear as day walk right behind a tree and just never came out the other side. And that was within an hour to 2 hours after even arriving. It was in broad daylight. And so it was pretty much immediate. We didn't have a whole lot of time to really plan, to be honest. We kind of got out, and the place was pretty overwhelming. And that first night was one of the most active nights I've ever had at any place I've ever been. And it was a little bit jarring, as a lot of places are when you're not familiar with them, when certain things really pop off real quickly and it's feeling very constant. And we experienced things that neither one of us had ever experienced before throughout the night. And so it was definitely an eye-opener for sure.
A daytime experience like that, is that unusual?
You know, personally, when I'm at a location that I feel is active, I can sometimes feel the energy, you know, whether it's a shift or there's some type of a feeling or mood in the air. And I think just over the years, a lot of investigators sort of developed that tendency to where they could really pick up certain things where it just doesn't feel normal. And that was immediate when we got down there. But personally, as far as something that vivid and that interactive, I have never personally had anything like that, not right there during the day. I have, you know, done successful EVP sessions and things of that nature during the day, but as far as a visual, I had something close to it during sunset as the investigations went on, but that was the closest thing I've ever had to a broad daylight experience as far as something I had seen.
So with all the places that you've been, Brendan, do you bring home sometimes these entities? Do they follow you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's certainly something that I think anybody that's out there doing it will do their best to try to protect against. I don't know that there's an exact science in doing so, but yeah, matter of fact, even to this day, sometimes I can feel a presence, and it actually manifests as something that I consider to be a really large, like a black dog. I can sometimes, there's a smell in the air that I catch, and I can see it out of my peripheral. I've never seen it straight on, but I always know it's there when it's there. And I have been followed home in the past with a previous investigation at a home. And that's actually the basis of my first book, The House Where Evil Lurks. And I was followed home by something really, really dark, and had an experience that certainly changed my approach as far as protection and being a little more cautious and careful during the investigation and, of course, after.
We're with Brandon Callahan, author of The Agony That Remains. You have since turned a lot of your time and attention to studying ley lines all around the planet, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really my passion when it comes to this type of research, because I feel like potentially it can lead investigators on the right path as far as being able to potentially anticipate geographic locations that might be susceptible to more unexplained activity. And it's, so far in my research, it's been pretty much foolproof. It's got a 100% track record as far as I'm concerned. And so I feel like it's a step towards actual progress in this field of research, where if you can anticipate a location geographically to being prone to maybe more activity, you can really start to focus your studies. And at that point in time, I feel like we could really see some progress as far as attempting to maybe find some real answers and certainly document things that have been very difficult to document.
Brandon, explain to the unknowing what ley lines are.
To me, ley lines, you'll find different theories, because ley lines stretch back over really millennia. Almost every culture has a form of ley line study, or even when you look back to the Aztecs, they were very in touch with astronomy and earth energy. And I feel like ley lines, as you look at them on a map, they appear similar to latitude and longitudinal lines, but they go in all different directions, and they'll have a tendency to intersect every now and again. I feel like these lines are it's almost like an invisible energy highway, natural energy that the Earth provides. And when they intersect, it's such a bump in this energy that it can have a tendency. You'll find that these intersecting points are really close to fault lines, and they're really close to a lot of different unexplained type occurrences. You'll see a lot of crop circles. Stonehenge is actually on an intersecting ley line point. So that's just an example. And so for me, being able to actually look at something tangible and get a visual and know where my research should probably take me, that feels like a lot of progress to me.
So as you walk around for, like, with a metal detector, you can find things. Is there any equipment out there, Brandon, that can detect ley lines?
I don't know that there is, to be honest with you. A lot of it is faith-based, and it actually took me 3 years of research to really find something that I felt like was a reliable source. A gentleman had been doing years and years of vortex and ley line research, and they had compiled a file that I'm able to actually overlay onto Google Earth, and it kind of draws me a map. And again, it took me years to find it. There's really no documented worldwide ley line map that you can physically hold, at least that I can find. And so the research really started with the history of ley line belief and ley line research in and of itself, and it stretches back to the Dark Ages and to the original indigenous people. And I've just been really, really fascinated with it. And a lot of it is based on their religious beliefs and how their societies used to function. They're all really closely tied. And so I think the history in and of itself is worth exploring.
Brandon, the geologists out here on the West Coast are talking about another big earthquake out here in Southern California. Might these areas, the San Andreas Fault and others that they're finding, do you think there are ley lines all over the place?
I feel like that's typically the case. The New Madrid Fault here in the Midwest,
yeah,
that really nobody knows about, is well overdue to go, and it's one of the largest, if not the largest, in North America.
Oh my God! When it went in the 1800s, the Mississippi changed direction for a while.
That's right, and St. Louis basically sits right on top of this
fault. Tell me about it. I can't get away from these things.
Yeah, well, and if it goes, and if it goes as big as they say it's going to go, I can tell you from personal experience, St. Louis has a bunch of big brick buildings, and they're all really old, and it will not withstand a really large earthquake.
Nor would the arch.
Catastrophic.
Yeah, I don't think the arch was built to be earthquake-proof.
No, I really don't think much of anything in St. Louis is. It's just not something that was really taken into consideration, and it would be absolutely catastrophic if something big happened. And I live in Kansas City, which is just across the state, and just a few weeks back, we felt a shake from an earthquake that originated down in Tulsa.
That's right.
And those are becoming more and more common. As a matter of fact, during our investigations down in Tahlequah, at the time, the largest earthquake recorded in Oklahoma history hit while we were inside this house, and I literally thought the house was going to come down on top of us. I had experienced a couple earthquakes when I was overseas in Turkey over the years, and so I kind of knew what was going on, but when you're right in the middle of an investigation, you have to wonder. And so we kind of kept it on the down low until someone outside that wasn't inside with us said something, and they confirmed it was an earthquake. But for a minute, we just thought that we just experienced one of the most ridiculous things of all time.
And back to the agony that remains, the area out here of the Trail of Tears. Tell us some of the strange things that happened during your investigation.
Well, you know, there have been a few instances over the years as I've investigated that a place will kind of, it seems to kind of get inside me a little bit. And having been told a lot of the anecdotes and stories from the Trail of Tears and their travels, I think it really just worked its way into my mind. And I started having very vivid and constant dreams, almost as though I was there, which I do go into detail in the book about these dreams. And when it came to the Trail of Tears, it left... I guess it brought with it just this sadness and this overwhelming devastation that I think just implanted itself in these different societies. And the thing is, it was such a tough time. You know, I came to find out just how brutal the lifestyle was for these people once they were supplanted there. And they really, in a lot of cases, took it out on each other. So you start hearing about curses on the lands and demonic activity that's been summoned and assigned to assault and hurt people. And, you know, it really digs really deep, really fast. And, you know, that was one of the most frightening things was just the psychology of it. Just trying to wrap my brain around and look at it from the perspective of these just broken and desperate people. And it was difficult.
Indeed it was. Did you encounter beings, entities?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, some of it's just kind of, even as I start thinking about it, I get the chills. One instance in particular took place in a cemetery that a lot of the family members were buried in or are buried in from the family I was working with. And I was told really early on to be very respectful and careful in that place, which whenever we go into cemeteries, we never do any provoking or anything like that. We're there more to observe than anything. And when we walked into this place, the ground felt like a sponge, and it happened that way year round. It didn't matter if it was dry or wet. It was just this soft, very obviously sacred and temperamental ground. And as I was kind of alluding to earlier, there was one evening right at sunset, and I had my camera pointing right where the sun was setting, but I encountered this creature, very hard to describe. But it came up on me so fast through the woods that were just outside the cemetery.
Was it physical or dimensional?
As it manifested itself, it was very physical because it was leaning against a tree and it looked like a person. And almost as though it had one leg up on the tree stump and it was just kind of leaning against it, just really relaxed and chilled. But it didn't respond when I said something. I was trying to introduce myself, thinking maybe one of the locals might take exception for us being out there. And as it turned to me, it grew, and it appeared no longer as a person, but it looked like it was made of mirrors. I always equate it to the movie Predator, when the Predator is...
Yeah, kind of that see-through, clear look, that waves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, and it grew so huge, so big, and it actually split. It actually moved one of the trees as its shoulder area came up through these two trees, and it just stood there. And for about 3 minutes, I mean, this whole encounter was about 3 minutes long, and I've just got this audio that I've listened to 1,000 times as it was happening, because the cameras were useless because of the position of the sun. And this thing just really just stood there, and I couldn't see eyes, but I knew it had engaged me. And it had basically, it felt like it had me under a spell of some sort, because it just stood there, and it just kept swaying back and forth, just real calmly. And after about 3 minutes, it just tore off just as quickly and loudly as it came in. And I didn't know what hit me. I didn't know what to think. There had been so many reports of Bigfoot sightings and alien sightings and UFOs and all these creatures, even shapeshifters. In the Native American culture, you're going to hear about shapeshifters.
Yes.
Whether you think it's the most outrageous thing you've ever heard or not, you're going to hear about it. And when they tell it to you, it feels extremely legit. And so I really didn't know what I had encountered, but it was the physical encounter, or the visual encounter, that I had been, I guess, waiting for, but then I didn't know how to respond to it. It had me just completely frozen. I could hardly think. It was just insane.
Brandon Callahan with us. Brandon, did you feel the entity's pain in the agony that they went through? Did you feel that?
I feel like I did in a lot of ways, mentally, because, again, it had this such a hard effect on my subconscious. And it was nightly almost, and it ended up physically affecting me as well. There was one night after an investigation down there that I had felt like we had uncovered some really serious truths that we had been really looking for, that I felt gave us a few answers. And all of a sudden, the whole ride home, I felt out of place. And within a day, I actually had to stop. It was in the middle of the night. I was taking my notes, which usually turn into my books. And I was taking my notes, and I just felt this crunching pain in my face. And so I went inside my bathroom, and I just started taking these selfie pictures, and because I just felt like my face was just almost shrinking or holding up.
Yeah.
And sure enough, my face was physically altered.
That's scary.
It looked like I aged about 60 years.
Oh, my God. Like Bell's palsy or something.
Something, yeah. It was that scared me, obviously. And so, you know, at that point in time, I didn't really know how to digest everything. And it was like a drug. The place was like it had hooked me. And there wasn't any way that I was going to stop going down there. And, you know, in some ways, I certainly look back and I wonder what I was thinking. But it was just one of those things. With every new experience, I just had to go back for more. I just needed to see what else this place could provide me personally. It turned into this personal thing, this quest for knowledge, and it was really dangerous. But at the time, I didn't acknowledge the danger. I just felt like I had to be down there.
We're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take your phone calls with Brandon Callahan. One of our past guests, Stephen LaChance, calls Brandon's work scary as H. We'll be back.